So we are going to be kicking off our appeals and grievance team best practices for initial determinations and appeals and grievances panel. So first off, we have Yolanda Morris. She is the health plan compliance manager for St. Joseph Heritage Healthcare. Yolanda is in her role, oversees regulatory compliance for delegated functions within the organization related to regulatory audits, health plan audits, regulatory reporting, and compliance issues. Then we have Robert Williams. Robert is a supervisor for Medicare operations for Blue Shield of California. In his role, he oversees Medicare customer care and share oversight of compliance activities that directly impact his unit. Then with CMS, we have Christy Sugarman Coates. Christy is an account manager for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services here in Sacramento. And she serves as a co-lead for the appeals and grievance team in the San Francisco Regional Office. And participates in Medicare program audits as a lead for a Part CODAG and SARDAG audit areas. And then we have Lucy Sadania. Lucy's current role includes outreach activities to provide technical assistance to pharmacists and other healthcare professionals and beneficiary advocates to assure the goals and objectives of CMS strategic plan are achieved that are related to the Medicare Part D program. And then certainly, last but not least, from CMS, we also have Julian Kwok, who is a lead regional account manager in the San Francisco office, and her responsibilities include assisting Medicare beneficiaries, marketplace consumers, advocacy groups, providers, and congressional representatives in providing technical assistance to Medicare health plans, PDPs, and QHPs. So with that, I would like to welcome our panel to the stage.
I'm Christy Sugarman Coates, and I am an account manager in the CMS San Francisco office. I'm going to be covering Medicare Part C organization determinations, appeals and grievances, or the ODAG program area, and giving you some highlights from our audits this past year. So I'm going to start off with some important policy reminders. Go through some best practices, and then I'll have some important ODAG resources at the end. So the first policy reminder that I want to share is that the denial notice language needs to be specific to the request. So in our audits, we often see issues with our denial notices, either not being having enough information or often having way too much information, and we want to make sure that you're using the approved model notice in a readable and understandable manner, and it needs to include the specific reason for the denial, and the policy decision or the CMS local coverage determination in the notice, and what's needed to actually cover the item. We also want to see that the enrollee's right to appeal and representation is in the notice. The description of the appeals process and time frame, and the enrollee's right to submit additional information as well. Those three middle bullets there are already in our updated templates. So if you're using those updated templates, then you are set with those three areas. And then the last one there is that if there's any, I'm having trouble, hang on. Okay, an explanation of the provider's refusal to furnish an item or service if applicable. And that's really only if applicable. Those don't need to be in the notice unless their provider's refusing to provide services. The next important policy reminder is to render appropriate organization determinations and appeal decisions. So we want to see that your medical director and the team is making the best decision for your enrollees, that they're providing coverage or payment for all services that are supported by Medicare Part A and B and that are in the plan service area. We want to make sure that it's complying with CMS national coverage determinations, general coverage guidelines, such as our CMS manuals or your evidence of coverage, and to be written and written local coverage policy determinations. And this is an area where we do see findings with our audits inappropriate coverage decisions is often a finding. So making sure that your medical director and team are up to date on the most recent coverage determination and CMS guidelines is really important. The third area where we do see some findings is around quality of care. So we want you to properly identify and include QIO information in your resolution letters to the enrollees. You need to investigate and respond in writing within 30 days for any quality of care concern. And if there's an extension that needs to be taken, then you need to notify the enrollee in writing of that extension. The resolution letter should include a description of the enrollee's right to file a complaint with the BFCC QIO and include the contact information for the QIO. And then if a complaint is filed with a QIO, the plan needs to cooperate with the QIO as well to help resolve any issues. Okay, so some best practices. These are some things that we see in audits, and we often want to call them out when we do see best practices being used in audits. And some things to remind you. So oversight of delegated entities, especially in California, because a lot of the plans are using delegates quite a lot. It's ultimately your responsibility as a plan to make sure that they're following all requirements and guidance. You're ultimately responsible for everything your delegates do, so it's really important that you understand or that you recognize that they're following all requirements. Conduct routine monitoring and training of all delegated entities to oversee their compliance and verify that the policies and procedures, including the mailroom policies, are all up to date. And then finally, and this is an important one, audit your delegated entities to validate that they are ready for a CMS audit. When you receive your audit notice, your engagement letter, you want to make sure they're ready to go. So include them in the process for preparing and submitting universe data, and make sure you're evaluating their timeliness as well. So another one that's important is when we make updates to policy or guidance, it's really important that you're updating your internal documents and processes as well. So hopefully you all know that in February we released the new chapter guidance that took the place of chapter 13 and 18, and it was the Part C and D enrollee grievances, organization, coverage determinations, and appeals guidance, and it was a combined chapter. When we issued this new guidance, we took down both chapters 13 and 18, which means if you had any links to those chapters, they no longer work. So it's really important that you reviewing all of your internal documents or any notices that you're sending to enrollees to make sure that all those links are updated and are active. So make sure you're looking over your policies and procedures, internal processes, links. And then if you've developed any checklists, workflow documents, and reference materials for your staff to use when they're going through any appeals or grievances, then make sure those are updated as well. And then include your delegates in the process and make sure that their processes and documents are updated as well. And then finally, make sure you're training all your staff on all of these updates so that they do understand that changes were made to any of their internal documents. And this one is also super important. A good quality assurance and oversight process of your initial determinations, appeals, and grievances is very important. It'll help you ensure consistency, catch any errors before things are sent out. So if you have notices and you're doing some quality assurance of the notice before it goes out and you see there's something incorrect in it, you can fix it. You can make sure that your time frames that maybe aren't being met, you can get that letter out a little bit quicker. So depending on the need, make sure you're monitoring your operational areas either daily, weekly, or monthly, or all three if needed. You can kind of adjust it as you need to. And then all of those areas that I've already covered, you would have some oversight over the denial notice, inappropriate decision making, or any quality of care to make sure that you're catching all those quality of care issues. I would highly suggest your customer service areas included in this, that your timeliness and decision making. Classification is always an area where we see issues. And then forwarding complaints to the correct department is also an important one. You want to make sure they're getting to the right place so that they can resolve them. This chart is one that we like to have on our slides each year because it's a great overview of the time frames and the flow from the first level all the way through. It also gives you the amount of controversy that's needed for a member to take their appeal all the way through. It's a handy chart that I think we all sometimes have on hand as well. And then finally, I have some ODAD resources here, the new chapter guidance I have there at the top. There's two HPMS memos that were important this year. There's a new one on the QIO contractors that changed. Originally came out in May, and then there was a correction memo in June. And then the 2018 program audit and enforcement report came out in September. That's always a good one to look over. It gives you, it lists out the plans that were audited, and it gives you overview of their findings, and it looks through them in a couple different ways. So it's always interesting to look through that report. The Maximus reconsideration manual and the Code of Federal Regulations are there. And then one thing I do want to point out is we changed the mailbox. It's there at the bottom. This is for both Part C and D. It's the appeals and grievance mailbox, and it's now through our LMI portal instead of the old mailbox we were using. And I think they're able to respond a little bit quicker this way too, so highly encourage you, if you have questions, to utilize that mailbox. Okay, now I'm gonna turn it over to Lucy, who's going to discuss Part D coverage determinations, appeals, and grievances.
Okay, hi everybody. My name, as was mentioned earlier, is Lucy Saldana. I'm the Region 9 pharmacist in the San Francisco office, and I do CDAG in the program audits, so I'm going to bring some of my knowledge to you today. So in my presentation today, I'm going to talk to you about some common issues that I found in the program audits this year, the 2019 season, and I'll bring some related best practices to those issues. And also I'll be pointing out just a few areas in the new guidance, the enrollment guidance that we're all referring to that was finalized February 22nd of this year. And then, as Christy did, we'll talk about some CDAG resources. So, as I mentioned, I'll be talking about two issues or citations that rose to the top area for those sponsors that have challenges in my presentation, things that we found in the audits. But first, what I wanted to do is mention to you some of the other types of issues that came across when I was doing auditing. And I saw them maybe once or just a few times. They didn't rise to the top. So you might not necessarily see them when you see the report come out of the 2019. And maybe some of you sitting here actually had audits. And so they may not be on your audit list. But I thought these might be helpful, especially for anybody that has the Part D issues. So I'll just run through them quickly, and you might be able to identify, might find them helpful. Things such as failure to auto-forward coverage determinations and or redeterminations, and that would be standard or expedited, to the IRE for review or disposition. Sponsor made inappropriate denials when processing coverage determinations. Sponsor failed to appropriately consider clinical information when rendering a decision. Sponsor did not effectuate exception approvals through the end of the sponsor year. Sponsor did not provide denial notices that use the approval notice language in a readable and understandable form, including specific reasons for the denial and information regarding the enrollee's right to a redetermination or reconsideration. Sponsor inappropriately dismissed a coverage request. And sponsor inappropriately processed a coverage determination, a redetermination, or a grievance without submitted valid AOR or other conforming documents having it on file. Oops. Did I skip one? Let's see. Okay. So the first common issue I wanted to talk about were denial letters not having adequate rationale. So denial, so some of the contributing factors to this issue we found were the use of copy and paste templates and broiler language without a quality assurance process in place. So anyone can make a copy and paste error. But if you don't have a good quality process in place, one or two errors can turn into multiple errors, hundreds. And as you know, complex drugs with multiple FDA approvals can be used for multiple uses. And so the denial reason must, of course, match the diagnosis that it was requested for. And that sometimes too many entities, more for the bigger plans involved, that the sponsor, sometimes they contract with multiple vendors for a single process stream. And it's important that they have to make sure that it's hard to maintain compliance. So for best practices, for the denial notice rationale, you want to make sure you know the drug, the dose, and the administration. You want to make sure you review your case system for the denial reason. And you want to review approved formulary criteria for that drug. And you want to make sure you're using the correct notice template. And when you're writing the denial rationale, you want to make sure you explain requirements for enrollees to try and fail specific drugs, and it's specifically formulary drugs. And rationale should match the case notes on why the request was denied. And finally, you ask yourself, is the information that would be needed to approve coverage for the drug included in the letter? Again, if you have a good quality assurance process in place, you can catch errors that are made in all of the areas I just discussed. Denial notices are checked to ensure the correct template was used and includes specific reasons for the denial. The decision, you'll know that the decision was made appropriately. The second issue I wanted to mention was misclassification of coverage determination and redeterminations as grievances. And this is interesting because I don't think any of us expected this to rise to the top, especially because, as you know, for those of you involved with audits this year or were audited, we did not do call logs. We didn't look at call logs this year. So that's why I think we were surprised to see this one rise to the top. But so I actually included a citation for the regulations, and I highly recommend that, especially if you're going to be audited this coming year, that you would look at the regulation for the definition of all these topics, the coverage determination, redetermination, and grievance. So for best practice, the quality assurance and oversight of initial determination, appeals, and grievances. So I'm going to highly recommend that you go back to Christy's presentation that she just gave, and you look at her slide 8. She did for Part C, but what she gave for Part C is exactly what you need for Part D. And that is to ensure compliance is how you catch errors. And depending on your need, monitoring operational areas daily, weekly, or monthly. So the quality of care concerns would be investigated and responded to appropriately. Your delegates are making timely, correct decisions, and their policies are up to date. Any changes made to guidance are updated in your policies and procedures. And you continually train new staff and your regular staff for any of these updates. So I'm going to talk about these three areas in the new chapter, but I want to put a plug in first for tomorrow, Stacy Page from Central Office. Her title is, she's from the Division of Policy, she's from the Division of Appeals Policy, and she'll be here tomorrow at 1 o'clock in this room, and she's going to do a presentation on Medicare Advantage Part D Appeals and Grievance Update. And she'll be discussing features of the new chapter. She'll do an overview of new guidance based on recent regulatory and policy changes. I highly recommend you don't miss it.
because I'm going to just talk about three areas in the chapter, and very briefly, because we don't really have the time today, but she's going to talk a little more in depth. And I think this is an opportunity to really understand from the central office point of view what some of the updates and changes are. So I'm pretty excited. And I've heard it once before, but I'm going to be there tomorrow. So I highly recommend you are too. So just to go over these three areas, and the reason why I picked these three areas out of the new chapter, the new guidance, was because they're Part D, and I thought a lot of you that do the Part D area would find this of interest. But these are particularly of interest to me because these particular topics I've run across or have come to me when I'm doing the audits, and they've come surfaced. So the first one is outreach for additional information to support coverage decisions. So that's 10.6, and plans must have process in place for making timely coverage decisions. And the difference here is for the new guidance, it's a minimum of one attempt to obtain additional information is considered sufficient. And as you remember, previous to this, it was three is a minimum. You were required to do three attempts to get additional information. And so it goes on to talk about best practices in this chapter, in the new chapter, best practices of making multiple attempts using multiple methods for requesting information. And they talk about using fax, telephone, and email. So again, the old guidance was making three attempts is the minimum, and now one attempt is minimum, and three attempts is called best practices. And then for grievance, Area 30, in the new chapter, it goes on to define what a grievance is. A grievance is as they call it, dissatisfaction. And in the new chapter, they remove the term complaint to reduce confusion. And they've also included many new examples. And in the new chapter, it says plans determines whether the matter or the issue is a grievance, a coverage request, an appeal, or a combination of more than one category. And the plan must inform the enrollee verbally or in writing if the issue was a grievance or an appeal. And that was not required before. And then the third one is reopening guidelines. In the new guidance, the request to reopen can be verbally or in writing. Previously, it had to be in writing. The new guidance request to reopen can be verbally. Okay, sorry. The new guidance recommends 60-day completion from when you get the receipt for the request. And in the old guidance, there was no days of completion. The new guidance recommends states Part D plans are not required, but may process clerical errors as reopening. The old language requires the plan to open a clerical error as reopen a clerical error. And then lastly, revised guidance, the new guidance, states a change in denial rationale constitutes a revised determination and requires notification. That's the key. They require a notification to the parties of the determination. And previously, they did not state that in the guidance. So tomorrow, Stacy will talk a little bit more about these in depth. And again, this is the flow chart, the 2019 Part D coverage determination and appeals flow chart that we, as Christy mentioned, we show this yearly. And the difference is similar to 2018. It looks very similar to 2018. The difference is that in appeals level 1 and 2, we've added 14-day timeline for payment. And in the last last level, which is the judicial review level, we've listed the AIC, and for 2018, it's 1,600, and for this year, 2019, it's been raised to $1,630. And similar to the ODAG resources, we have the new Part D mailbox, which is combined with the Part C, as Christy mentioned. And it's a portal, and it's the appeals.lmi.org. So next we have, you're going to get information from the health plan and the provider organizations from Yolanda Morris, who's with St. Joseph Heritage Healthcare, and Robert Williams, who is with Blue Shield of California.
Thank you. Thank you, Kristen and Julian, for your presentation. So as Lucy shared, we're here today to talk about the perspective from the health plan and the provider organization. So our objectives for today is going to be focusing around lessons learned during the CMS program audits for 2019, as well as sharing some best practice reminders from the health plan perspective and the provider organization perspective. So some best practices for ODAC data validation. Many health plans know that CMS allows three opportunities for the ODAC data validation to make sure that you pass that validation. What we have seen be very successful is where the health plans are conducting ODAC data validations monthly for the ODACs that are submitted. There have been some plans that have designated employees that check the data to make sure it's accurate, as well as any system statuses or codes to ensure that it correctly reflects the denial or the approval. So that has been very successful, and in my experience, the plan communicates with the provider organization and makes sure that if there's any remediation that needs to take place, if there's a provider organization that's reporting denials that maybe are correct denials, but based on system, it doesn't appear to be correct, that's remediated prior to any CMS program audits. Another very good recommendation would be some of our plans. As a provider organization, we see that some of the Medicare Advantage health plans are conducting quarterly ODAC data validations where they're mirroring the CMS process, where they will select some cases from table one, table two, table three, and they allow the delegates a 1 hour turnaround time. So again, very similar to the CMS process. And the whole purpose of that is to allow the delegated entities to become really comfortable to speak on when the case was received, how it was processed, if it's a claim, how it was adjudicated, and how it was resolved. And also making sure that the data validation is accurate. There are sometimes certain discrepancies where we understand there could be system glitches. So this is also a time where you make sure that the system data is reflective with the reporting aspect of it. So that has been very successful and has also allowed the speakers and the drivers of those audits to really develop confidence with that process. Okay, we have some best practice for preparing for CMS program audits. There were a lot of CMS program audits this year, especially if you are a provider organization. I am sure you were very busy preparing for CMS program audits. So some recommendations we would have with our health plan partners would be to communicate with your delegated entities as soon as you are aware of a CMS program audit or as soon as you've received your CMS engagement letter, so that your delegates can really ensure that there's someone who's going to be there to support that audit. And also, one very a best practice is for the health plans to update your provider organization contact information, whether it's quarterly or semi-annually, just to make sure that when a CMS audit is scheduled and you need to reach out to your provider organization contacts, that you have your correct claim contact, your correct UM contact, your compliance contract at the provider group level. And again, this third bullet goes back to the mock audits. There are a lot of times where we have health plans that conduct the quarterly mock audits as it relates to the data validation. But a lot of things that we have seen really help and assist for CMS program audits is mock audits prior to the CMS program audits to really get your delegates prepared and think when it comes to presenting and really knowing the system. And for this slide, I'm going to be turning it over to Robert to present.
Hello, everyone. I'm Robert. So best practices during a program audit would be to carefully review your case file selection and acquainting yourself or becoming familiar with the cases. So that would include not only the life of the case, but also your internal systems, understanding where everything is at, so you can be better prepared to navigate through when the CMS auditor asks a question. Part of that is designating speakers and drivers, respectively, speakers that are knowledgeable about the processes in the system, and then also drivers that understand the various system that your plan may use. In the event that one of the speakers or the driver is unavailable, we do recommend that you have a backup speaker or backup driver that are too knowledgeable of the plans, processes, and systems. So the primary duty for the speaker will be to present speak to the CMS auditor. If they ask any questions, they'll be the one verbalizing, and the driver will be there to navigate through the systems based upon what's being asked by CMS. Of course, you can work with one another and potentially put yourself on a mute in the event that you do get a question from the auditor and you're not aware of it, or not aware of how to respond. You can put yourself on a mute, speak to the person next to you, or you can speak to someone that's in the room before you do respond to CMS. So part of that is also recommended to include key players from each impacted area. So primarily you'll see medical directors, customer service, pharmacy services, appeals of grievances, compliance, etc. We will recommend that you are all in a room, a war room, if you will, and part of that war room will include delegates from each area, and these individuals will be considered subject matter expert in the fields in which they are representing. So we recommend having them there in event prior slide where it says put on mute. You can then ask the individual that's in the room the question as well. And many times I've seen myself that everyone have different experiences, so they're able to speak up, or even if they start asking clinical questions, and although you may be the speaker, the medical director may be able to guide you and tell you what to respond with, so it's always helpful. We also recommend that you have flexible schedule to reply promptly to CMS when they are asking for something. Of course, it's best practice to respond to them quickly within 24 hours. However, you are able to ask for additional time, but to avoid doing that or avoid any delays, and to show that you are aware of your system and where information is at, it'll be best practice to go ahead and block out time, get with your delegated entities, and ensure that they too block out time and they're there in the event that you do need to request information from them. So part of that will also be blocking out time for yourself, the individual that's in the room, making sure that when you do get those requests, if you do, then you're responding to them promptly and timely, and having that flexibility and already going into the audit knowing that you're going to just be focused on the audit will be helpful. And we have the mail policy. So I want to send a reminder to everyone ensuring that they do have policies, procedures related to mail policies. That way it is aligned with reporting. So once you do report out, you have some policies to back it up. And in addition to that, you're sharing the same information or you have understanding of information for your delegated entities, because they too should be able to have their policies match the data or the reporting. So as Kristen mentioned, the health plan is responsible. So you will need to, you will want to get with your delegated entities and ensure that they too are having policy procedure related to mail policy and is matching the reporting. I'm going to turn it back over to Yolanda.
Thank you, Robert. I wanted to go back really quick on the mailroom policy. This has also been a focus this year during CMS program audits, during mock audits and live CMS audits, as well as last year, the 2018 We had a little sub-bullet point to just have knowledge of the internal mailing process. We do acknowledge that there are certain delegated entities or even health plans that may have different process for approvals versus denials, where denials can be done in-house and approvals can be done by a vendor. So that is really important that the speaker really knows that process, understand that, as well as if your vendors are in a different time zone, that is really reflected in your policy and procedure, because that can definitely impact reporting. So if that is the case for your organization, you want to be able to speak to that during a live CMS program audit, as well as have supporting documentation to support if you are in a Pacific Standard Time and your vendor is in Central Time Zone. So moving on to internal ongoing monitoring, here are some recommendations for oversight. And as we are all aware, the health plan is the one that retains the responsibility for anything that the delegated entity is doing. But for the delegated entity, just to make sure that you are also in compliance, we do recommend that both the health plan and the delegated entity continue to monitor timeliness internally. And if you are having challenges with meeting timeliness, that you conduct root cause analysis, because you really want to be able to know what the root cause of those challenges are to really remediate those and correct those. You don't just want to do a quick fix. You want to be able to get to the source of a problem, because as we know, with CMS, DMHC, the oversight is really increasing. The second bullet is it's for provider organizations, really recommending to monitor the integrated denial notices. Some of our health plans prefer to either post them through ICE, so we're aware when those denial notices are updated, and some of them email them directly to their contacts at the provider organization. So just making sure that you have a process in place so that you monitor your integrated denial notices, so that you're always sending out member denials in the most current template, and that you are also including the applicable inserts, the non-discriminatory insert, the language assistant program insert. And if this is applicable to you, that you send member notifications in the preferred and written language. If this falls under that 5% population for that health plan and a member's preferred language is part of that threshold, that you send out that integrated denial notice in that preferred language, and that you also keep a copy of the English letter as well as the letter in the threshold language, and that you save both of those letters for any audit purposes. Okay, so Robert and I are going to be covering this last slide.
Go ahead. So for documentation, we wanted to build awareness around the importance of documentation, and that's for both appeals and grievances and customer care. So if it's not documented, it didn't happen. That's something you can think of. During the program audit, CMS may not ask to speak or may not ask to listen to the call. They'll look at the case documentation. And in the event that you didn't input something that may have truly been done, it would be seen as if it hadn't been done. So building awareness around documentation is essential, and we highly recommend it. Parker documentation is having clear and concise notes, and also including any resolutions or actions taken to resolve the member's issue. So from a customer care standpoint, in an event that you do get a call and they do identify it as a grievance and they are able to bring resolution to it, there should be the life of the case should be pretty much in the system. And it should show that not only did they address the issue, but they actually resolved it and what they did to resolve it and how they resolved it. And also if the member was satisfied with the resolution or not. It's important to inform customer care that they too should be aware of categorization. They don't necessarily categorize things out as often as appeals and grievances, but they are expected to identify if a member is asking for a grievance, a coverage request, or both. So in the event that a member is complaining about something, they will need to dissect it and route it appropriately depending on what the issue is. CMS don't look for the member to use terminology. So it'll be for the agents to be able to identify it, apply it, and then move it in the direction it needs to go and let the member know, keeping them in the loop of the, where it's going.
So another bullet, ensure that the OIG exclusion checks are conducted for non-PAM providers prior to pre-service approvals. This has been a focus, and I know in the past it has been part of the CMS program, the compliance program effectiveness audits, but now if anything related to UM referrals and you're approving services for the member to see a specialist, whether you don't have the specialist in network or it's a different scenario, that you document that in the system. And this is different from your contracted providers, obviously. So those non-contracted providers wouldn't fall under the credentialing process. So lastly, similar to what Kristen and Lucy shared, really placing a lot of importance around the denial rationale to ensure clear and concise explanation to the member. The member has to be able to understand the basis for the denial, and you also want to make sure that you are in compliance with the UM regulatory requirements of your hierarchy criteria, and citing that the criteria that was used to make that clinical decision making. And sometimes we understand there could be challenges to writing that denial rationale, but we also want to make sure that everyone knows to just ensure that it's at an eighth grade reading level for the member notification to assure compliance with that Medicare requirement. So these are just some recommendations, some best practices from the health plan and provider organization perspective. We did take some questions for the last couple of months from our ICE Appeals and Grievance Improvement team. So Julen, the account manager for CMS, has prepared some answers to provide to the audience today, and then we will also have a little bit of time for questions and answers.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Yolanda, Robert. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Julen Kwok, and I work for CMS San Francisco. Thank you for attending our session. It's good to see some familiar friends and familiar faces in the audience. And as we were preparing for this session, we received a lot of requests to clarify regulatory citation 42 CFR 422.574D, parties to the organization determination. Specifically, please clarify who are the other party, who are the other provider or entity other than the Medicare Advantage organization determined to have an appealable interest in the proceeding. First, I would like to provide some background information. CMS did not make any changes to this section. And as Christy mentioned earlier, in February 2019, CMS did release the new Medicare Advantage and Prescription Drug Plan appeal guidance. This new appeals guidance combined Chapter 13 of the Medicare Advantage Care Manual and Chapter 18 of the Prescription Drug Benefit Manual. By combining and changing the layout of how the information was presented, we believe it inadvertently generated a lot of questions on the appealable interest requirement. Next, I would like to provide some historical insight. Generally, when CMS talks about who are the other provider or entity determined to have an appealable interest in the proceeding, CMS is almost always talking about a state Medicaid agency. The state Medicaid agency has an appealable interest, but it is not necessarily a party to the appeal. The state Medicaid agency would be responsible for coverage if the Medicare Advantage plan denies the coverage. Again, the state Medicaid agency's interest is to see the item or service in dispute being covered by the Medicare plan. Now, I want to discuss whether CMS requires an appointment of representative form for certain other providers or entities. Some examples of other providers or entities, such as contract, non-contract, durable medical equipment suppliers who have been providing services, physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists who have been providing care, skilled nursing facility providers who have been providing care. All of these providers do require an AOR form to file a request on the beneficiary's behalf. Next, I want to discuss about the requirements for nurse practitioner and physician assistant. If the PA or nurse practitioner is obviously working with a beneficiary's physician, then an AOR form is not required. It's not required. In general, a nurse practitioner or PA works under a physician or is affiliated with a medical group. As a friendly reminder, this requirement is different for a payment request. For payment request, CMS requires a waiver of liability form for any non-contract provider, regardless of whether or not it is a physician, in order to protect the beneficiaries from financial harm. Let's do a quick knowledge check, just by show of hands. Question number one, for pre-service requests, would CMS require an AOR form from a non-physician, such as a DME, PTOT, speech therapy, who clearly is not affiliated with a physician or any medical group, by show of hand? If you think the answer is yes. Anyone? You are correct. Yes, CMS would require an AORA form. Thank you. Question number two. For pre-service requests, would CMS require an AOR form from a nurse practitioner or PA who clearly is affiliated with the beneficiary's physician? Raise your hand if you answer no. Thank you. And you are correct. No, CMS would not require an AR form as long as there is evidence to show that the nurse practitioner or PA is affiliated with the beneficiary's physician. Question number three, for pre-service requests, does it matter if the nurse practitioner or physician assistant practices in different state or in urban or rural area, as long as the request shows evidence of the affiliation to the beneficiary's physician? Raise your hand if you answer no. And I agree with you. The physical location of the nurse practitioner or a physician assistant does not matter, as long as there's documentation to show the affiliation that the provider is working under the beneficiary's physician. Again, I will talk about the supporting documentations later. Last question, would CMS require an AOR form from state Medicaid agency? Raise your hand if you answer no. Okay, and I agree with you. Thank you. CMS would not require an AOR form from state Medicaid agencies. As mentioned earlier, the state Medicaid agencies have an appealable interest, and they would be responsible for coverage if the Medicare plan denies the coverage. Now, I wanted to spend some time talking about what CMS and the IRE consider as evidence to show the affiliation. As best practices, Maxima suggests the following. When Medicare plan submits the reconsideration background data form, Maximus has been advising plans that if the provider is appealing and is affiliated with the beneficiary's physician, Maximus has been asking the plan to explain the relationship in the appellant section. In other words, it is best to fill out the appellant section first with the name and title, Betty Smith, nurse practitioner. Next, with the affiliation, the office of Dr. John Brown. Last, with the physician's address. If the Medicare plans complete the reconsideration background data form in this way, clearly showing the name, the affiliation, and the physician's address, it is clear that no AR form would be required. However, if the Medicare plans just submit the reconsideration background data form only with the name and the address, absent the affiliation, and there is no other evidence of the affiliation between the nurse practitioner and the beneficiary's physician found in the case filed, then the ARR form would be required. In summary, the easiest way to include the affiliation is in the appellant section. Another option is to flag the affiliation in the case file by using the letterhead, the medical records, or the same address to show both parties are affiliated. If Maximus can clearly see such affiliation, then Maximus would be lenient with the AR requirement. This concludes what we want to share with you on this topic.